The thing I love about working out and doing it consistently is seeing the progress and feeling the progress. There's a little bit of a hit psychologically in the best way possible when someone's like, oh, you're in shape, or oh, how'd you do this, right? That's very fleeting. And I would say don't pursue that as the end goal, but instead, when you're able to remember what it was like sweating after you walk up a flight of stairs, or being gassed after having to sprint when you didn't think you had to run, right? So there's so much to just think on and think over when starting to become more active, and then falling in love with it, and then doing it until it is a part of who you are. Yeah, that's that. A little bit of a inspiration though is my man's Jack LaLanne, and I'm actually a little bit surprised on how many people have not heard of him, but typically people who are 20 years older than me, of course, know who he is, because he set the precedent for gyms as we know it, right? I'm saying gymnasium, Western gym, right? He invented, you could pretty much say he invented the gym and working out. The first health club he formed was in Oakland, California in, I think it was the 30s. Let me fact check this as we're talking, but he's the one who put the opportunity to work out virtually into every home in the United States, let alone international. It's the longest running syndicated fitness show, something like 1950s through the 80s. This guy was doing all that. So yeah, it was 1951 to 1985, the Jack LaLanne Show. And what was cool was he saw the problem with sugar and the obesity issues in the United States as being a major pandemic, an actual problem to address, and inspired countless celebrities, Schwarzenegger, but the whole thing was he formed this health club in Oakland, California, which then became the prototype for dozens of similar gyms. And he probably made bank when he sold it to Bally's. And from my perspective growing up, I always figured Bally's was more for women. Like, oh, that's the gym ladies go to, right? But that was part of the evolution in terms of marketing, and then what was the way women work out in groups was more heavily pushed at Bally's than, the free weights and the machines. That's why I never gravitated towards it. And was, well, you can catch me at the YMCA. You can catch me at LA Fitness, right? So one of the things was he invented multiple exercises and ways of doing it. Invented the pulley system. Invented the leg extension device and the Smith machine, right? So if that was not enough, my man's invented protein supplements, right? Well, just think about that. It's a $1 billion industry, and he had done this in the 50s, right? Invented resistance bands, protein bars, and heavily popularized juicing, right? Where you get the you get the machine and you crush whatever veggie, whatever fruit, and it just gives you the juice part of it, right? He didn't invent that part, but he just made it popular. I know Bruce Lee was really big into juicing. And then he invented the jumping jack, right? That's every PE class in the last, 70 years does the jumping jacks. Yeah, he invented that. What was really remarkable about him was he really targeted elderly people and the disabled in terms of promoting health and fitness and longevity when that was not really a thing. Like we overall kind of see it as Oh, that might be a hobby or a luxury if you're elderly and you might have to do it in terms of helping with mobility, but you don't think, oh, let me just get in shape when I'm 80 because I have to because it hurts and it's my joints ache. But he targeted them specifically to say there's actually a ton of benefits to do something that's brand new, even though you're advanced in age, right? The thing that put him on the map when I was a kid was the feats of strength that he would do on memorials or on his birthday. And one of them was when he was 70 years old, he was handcuffed and shackled and towed 70 boats carrying a total of 70 people a mile and a half through Long Beach Harbor. To be specific, though, it was minimal movement, not zero movement. So if you're taking the strict definition of the word bound and shackled, you'd probably think handcuffed by police, right? You can't really move your wrists around, and then shackled at the feet, you're not going to be able to really walk. You got quarter steps, right? Well, it was bound by cord with a slightly more movement, but not, it was definitely not far from full functioning, but that's the only way you can actually do a breaststroke or a half breaststroke and doggy paddle. But that's not the point. The point is that was the level of resistance that he imposed upon himself to do this incredible feat of strength. And that's not even to mention the 70 people in the 70 boats that he was towing, right? For a mile, a mile and a half. Yeah. So this guy is no joke. And to be able to, not only just do that before it became cool, like lifting weights was not something that was a common practice in the 1930s, but then do it regularly and then promote it and then chase that dream and then, have it morph into what we see in 2024. That's something that's definitely noteworthy. Another one was setting the records for doing pull-ups. And this was in the 50s. So let's see. He did... Oh, let me skip for a second. In 1956, when he was 42 years old, he set the record for 1,033 push-ups in 23 minutes. Right. So in the 1950s, he was going beyond what was thought possible. And if you're in the military or if you were an athlete, you wouldn't have been a stranger to push-ups. But 1,000 push-ups, that would have been something that was seen as far-fetched, and he was able to do this pretty regularly, right? In 1957, age 43, he swam the Golden Gate Channel, towing 2,500 pounds, which was in a cabin cruiser. So he pulled the cabin cruiser behind him, and he swam against the current for a mile, which equates to 6.5 miles because of the resistance. Yeah. In 1958, age 44, Jack LaLanne maneuvered a paddleboard nonstop from Farallon Islands to the San Francisco shore. That's 30 miles on a paddleboard. It took him 9.5 hours. In 1959, age 45, Jack LaLanne did 1,000 push-ups and 1,000 chin-ups in 1 hour, 22 minutes to promote the Jack LaLanne show. He said, and I quote, "The most difficult of my stunts, not only because it was a record, but because the skin on my hand started ripping off during the chin-ups." He felt he couldn't stop because it would have been seen as a public failure. That is actually one of the biggest obstacles to breaking the chin-up record. And my man, so David Goggins, had said it in 2013 for 4,030 pull-ups in 24 hours. I think he did it in a little less than that. But since then, it's been broken. And not only was it broken, but someone had doubled it. So they did 8,000. And then this year, there was a man in Japan who did something short of 9,000 pull-ups in 24 hours. And throughout all of this, there comes a point where not only do you have to tape your hands, but you wear gloves, and then you wear the gloves out because of the friction. And then at a certain point, you're still taking a lot of hits to the calluses because of that. All right, back to Jack LaLanne. 1974, age 60. For the second time, he swims from Alcatraz Island to Fisherman's Wharf. He was handcuffed, but this time he was shackled and towed 1,000 pounds in a boat, right? Yeah, so some of these things are so outrageous, but it's a moment of just saying, what am I capable of doing? You know, no one really tried to run a sub-4 mile, because the myth was, if you ran faster than, if you could beat a 4-minute mile, your heart would explode. That type of deterrent would probably keep most people from even attempting to do it. And even if it was like, oh, hey, I'm going to try and make sure my mile gets down to 4 minutes and 30 seconds. I don't want to risk making my heart explode. That would still be something that would be seen as extreme. And now that's almost standard for collegiate track and field, that people be running 4-minute miles, right? In 1976, age 62, Jack LaLanne, in order to commemorate the spirit of 76, the United States bicentennial, he swam 1 mile in Long Beach Harbor. This time, same deal, handcuffed, shackled, but he towed 13 boats representing the 13 original colonies, containing 76 people total. Put yourself in the water. Imagine swimming a mile. I haven't tried to swim a mile in ages. I think the last time was probably around 2012. And it took me, I think it took me 30 minutes. And I was zapped. And I had worked up to that. I know that's nothing close to what other people are doing who swim regularly or swim for long distances. But in terms of someone who doesn't do that, something that I worked up to, I'm like, wow, I can't believe people do this all the time, right? All right. In 1979, Jack LaLanne towed 65 boats in Lake Ashinoko near Tokyo, Japan. Handcuffed and shackled, the boats were filled with 65,000 pounds of Louisiana Pacific wood pulp. 6,500 pounds of wood pulp. Yeah, that's something else. Why do I go on about Jack LaLanne? It's because if you can think of it and you can imagine it, look to see if someone else has done anything close to it. Get inspired, hold on to that, and you can go beyond. You can definitely go beyond. This is a practice that I get into regularly, especially when I'm feeling the humdrum ordinariness of life and the routine. Well, how do you spice things up? How do I stay operating at a high level for the demands of the workout and the lifestyle? Oh, easy. Look at someone like Jack LaLanne. Look at someone like Jackie Robinson. Look at someone like Mac Robinson. Look at someone like Mike Tyson, right? And speaking of Iron Mike, the fight's back on. Him and Jake Paul going at it November 15th. I do not see this going well for Jake Paul, even though he won the other day when there was the original postponement of the fight, and then he fought this other guy. I can't just, it's like comparing apples and oranges. There's age differences alone. There's something about being a fighter since birth and being the youngest heavyweight champion of the world, that's something that you can't just train for. I see it sort of like the anime Afro Samurai, starring my man's Samuel L. Jackson. In the premise of the movie is, in order to be the number one headband, the best fighter in the world, you have to beat him, but you have to be number two. If you're the number two headband, that's the only person who can fight the number one headband. That's the only person who can challenge the number one headband. Everyone else outside of that can only fight the number two headband, right? So everyone who steps up to duel, everyone wants to fight. You can only step to number two, can't step to number one. Number two can step to number one anytime. So that creates a pecking order that seems more reasonable, more logical. Jake Paul is a YouTuber who has access, and, you know, despite how I feel about him, he can get the best personal trainers, he can get the best nutritionists, he can get the best strategists, coaches, he can have the best dietitian in the world, he can have access to all the equipment. And I don't think that is a factor that we don't really consider. But in terms of having the chops and then the pedigree, this is not there. It goes back to the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours to be a master of a certain practice or form. Jake Paul's not there. If he's stacking his wins now, I think it comes out to be something like he's 6-0. Mike Tyson was 37-0 before he took his first L, right? In the first 19 fights, it was 12. There were 12 of them were first round knockouts. This is just another stratosphere of being a champion, right? So I know, according to the internet, a lot of skeptics are discrediting Mike Tyson as being an old man. There are 58-year-olds who are out of shape and are washed up and are old by competing standards. Mike Tyson is not one of those people, though. You know, this is someone who has been tried in the furnace, in the crucible of the ring, and found to be outperforming people younger and older than him. To step to Mike Tyson, Iron Mike, is just, that seems like a fool's errand. So we'll see what happens close to Thanksgiving. Just to put a little bit more in perspective, we can put accolades and awards and notoriety aside for a moment. Mike Tyson, when he was training, he would train for 8 to 10 hours a day. That's what Olympians do. The diet revolved around being able to keep the carbs high enough to be able to train for 8 to 10 hours a day. And then he would train 7 days a week. So to recover, I'm thinking about me being sore right now from doing sprints yesterday would be nothing compared to 5,000 pushups, 5,000 chin-ups, 5,000 crunches, an hour of doing wrestler's bridges, right? These are all exercises that were the bread and butter of his routine. And he doesn't just stay in one zone of training. He experiments with cutting edge technology to do the most effective and the most challenging ways to stimulate the muscle and get your VO2 max up, right? The ability to deliver oxygen through the blood to the rest of the body, right? That's VO2 max. The more efficient your VO2 max is, the better in shape you are and the more endurance and stamina that you have, right? It's what, it gives you the ability not just to breathe in the lungs, but get the nutrients where they need to go to be intense, right? Mike Tyson is doing like the wildest stuff that's not available at gyms because it is so experimental, right? He's doing all this like shock treatment while lifting weights that it forces the muscles to contract already. And then also, I think it, you know what? I think I said it wrong. I think it makes the muscle expand. So in order to contract the muscle, it's way more challenging. So when you're doing a bicep curl, you have along that path of the muscle shortening, that's the contraction part, and you're pulling your arm up, that force that you're using is what's tearing the muscles apart. And when you flex, you can feel it, right? You decline, right? You bring the motion down in the negative, and there's still resistance, so you don't just drop the weights, right? Imagine now you have these electrodes strapped to you, and they're the way that the current is going toward your muscles, it's hard to flex, right? So now put weight in your hand, even if it's 5 pound weight in your hand, and you have the stimulus not allowing you to contract with the same force. Yeah, that's going to be like being in the water, hauling, or I should say towing boats with people in them, or 6,500 pounds of wood pulp. This is absurd, right? That's what Mike Tyson is doing, and he's training specifically to fight Jake Paul. I've seen Jake Paul's workouts, and they're tough. That's like what the staple is for boxers, right? I don't know. I got to do more research to see the specifics of his range, like when he throws a punch, how far can he reach, the weight. What was the standard of Mike Tyson? I know it was between, as a heavyweight boxer, he was easily between 218 pounds and 222 pounds, like standard. That's like fight ready, right? What's their height difference? But in terms of just being a strategist, in terms of knowing the technique, Mike Tyson has been doing this over and over and over and over. He's the Hatoru Hanzo from Kill Bill, right? The legendary samurai swords that are unbreakable, right? Every metaphor, every analogy falls apart at some point. You know, Mike Tyson clearly can be beaten. He's been beaten a couple times in his career. But this is just a moment where this is not just an old dog who, you know, can't fight anymore and has arthritis and all these issues. No. This is a guy who doesn't look too much different than when he was in his prime. And that's the difference between people who are in that level of being a champion, right? One of the stories my grandfather talks about is he went to some event, and this is in Chicago, and there was a guy who had placed, it was either gold or silver in the Olympics in the 1930s, right? So these people are, they're ancient. they're seasoned. They're seasoned in terms of their life experience. And when he came up to receive the award, he bolted up from his seat and ran to receive the award, just to display that as someone who's pushing 100 years old could still do it. And that is showing what is humanly possible, and not falling prey to the standard of what people think older people look like, right? By American standards, Mike Tyson's not even retirement age. Well, I guess he's getting up there. 65 is that age where you say he retired. Yes, he retired from being a boxer, but he definitely is still doing stuff business-wide. I know he has the world's most popular vaping device. I know he has a podcast, doing a podcast daily. How many times have you seen him in movies, right? Shout out, what is it? It Man 5. He's been in The Hangover, was in a ton of movies, right? So he's very much active. He's a family man. He's doing stuff with the community. I've seen him commentating He's probably getting royalties for these video games, right? From all these systems. And he definitely is, I forget what the name of the law firm is, but me and my lady went to Vegas and we saw this, you know, you see those billboards promoting law firms. And this one guy's like, hey, I'll fight for you. And then on the other end of the billboard was Mike Tyson's face. And I was like, hey, babe, you think Mike Tyson is actually part of that? Or they're just using his image and likeness? Did a little Googling. Yeah, he's part of that. He endorses that law firm. So big shout out to them because he's a brand. He's a logo, right? This is what Jake Paul's going up against. Not just, oh, older guy who's past his prime. You're trying to fight an Olympian status athlete. I don't fancy myself great at the nunchucks and would fight anyone with nunchucks. Right? That's just something to work on hand-eye coordination. To step into that arena of martial arts with nunchucks, I'd be destroyed. Not even close. If I were to practice for 5 years and then intensely train, I'm still not going to be at that level to fight with someone who has been doing that since they were a teenager, right? Let alone someone who won that title, whatever the ranking is, the belt, at age 20 and has been doing it since, right? I think there you could make a curve shown on a graph on the likelihood of getting closer to being able to compete with it. And I'd give it 10 years. If I focused 10 years on that, dedicated my life to it, I might stand a chance. But that would also be dependent on the person who I'd be facing off against declining at what they do and doing that. And so just knowing that, I wouldn't even attempt to put it out there to do it. So we're going to, maybe I'll change my tune come November 16th, you know, the day after it happens. But until then, I will maintain my stance that Jake Paul does not stand a chance against Mike Tyson. All right. Speaking of fights, I got to talk about this fight. Danny Trejo getting in a fight on 4th of July. Turns out, I don't know. It's kind of having this existential moment, just thinking out loud and hearing myself talk. I assume people heard of this or at least got a snippet of it just in passing. But the short and skinny of it is, in the 4th of July parade here in LA, someone threw a water balloon at threw a water balloon at Danny Trejo, and things escalated and they got in a fist fight. Danny Trejo is another person I wouldn't mess with. And he's 80. He's 80 years old. My man from Machete, that's Machete, right? Machete. That's the silent assassin from Desperado. When I saw Desperado as a kid, I thought Danny Trejo was the scariest person on the face of the planet. Like, just looking at his face, he looks like a scary person, let alone he lifts up his vest and he's got all these knives, these throwing knives from every angle, right? A huge tattoo on his chest of what oddly looks like Selma Hayek, but that's not the point. The point is, doing a little research on Danny Trejo, turns out he was slightly effeminate as a kid, and his dad would physically abuse him to have him man up. Now, I don't condone domestic violence, not for a second. I'm just pointing out to the past of what led to Danny Trejo having the reputation that he had, right? His role model, he didn't have the affection of his father. His role model was his uncle Gilbert, who was a drug dealer, dealt heroin back in the day, in the 60s, right? He took him under his arm. He looked up to him. He wanted to be him, right? He gets busted for drug dealing and goes to San Quentin prison, right? And I also will assume most people have heard of San Quentin. It's like saying Rikers Island or Alcatraz, right? These are some infamous prisons in the United States, right? In San Quentin, to put it in perspective, that's where Charlie Manson was, right? So Danny Trejo got known as someone who would provide protection for you if you were afraid of getting shanked. So he'd walk around as your personal bodyguard, and that's how he made a ton of money in jail. Out of that, when he's released and he's been rehabilitated, he's working on set. I don't know what he was doing on set. I think he was, someone was saying, there's a bunch of actors with, these painted on tattoos playing gang members in this movie. We want someone who can give them advice on what to do. And when the second people on set saw Danny Trejo, they're like, yo, get in here. You're gonna have to do this, right? So that's where he got to start. I feel like this was the early 80s in a boxing movie. But the whole thing that I'm getting at was, from there, the most famous movie that he had done that put him on the map was Desperado, once again, as the silent assassin. So if you watch this movie, it's one of the most memorable scenes. I mean, I guess you could argue some of the weapons that are coming out of the guitar case from Antonio Banderas, but it's the level of authenticity that lets the character breathe and be itself in the world of the movie, right? That was not a moment of someone acting that way. That was something that had been built up, right, over time, since childhood. So fast forward in time, you have a ton of other movies that Danny Trejo's in, not to mention, pop culture references and cartoons and voiceovers and like rom-coms, right? But you have someone who had a reputation as being the most cutthroat guy in Pacoima, right? You have this guy who's known as being lethal protection in San Quentin prison, right? He comes out and he's no longer trying to be like that. He no longer is doing drugs or drinking. He's a straight shooter, straight red. What do they call it? Straight edge. He's a straight edge guy. He's been converted. And he's letting people know that he's gentle and he's here to help and to make the world a better place by being altruistic and charitable. But yet that persona follows him everywhere he goes. By the grace of God, it got him really famous in the movies because of it. But that's not actually what he's like anymore, right? Those were his young years. And so now he's a family man, a man of the community. You might catch him at Danny Trejo's Tacos, right? I don't know how frequently he's at the brick and mortar. I've definitely seen him in the truck in Lincoln Heights. And I'm like, yo, that's Machete. That's great. I digress. The whole thing is, he is someone who was fighting against what became a habit of being violent, right? So here we are. A couple weeks ago, July 4th, someone provokes him. Even though he's, by all intents and purposes, an elderly person. He's 80 years old. This is not the person you want to antagonize, right? This is someone who's killed people before. He's seen people get murdered in front of him and not really react because he was in the world of violence in prison, right? So it was clear. The person was just trying to get a rise out of him and provoked him. But the problem is, when you provoke someone like that, they don't really just diffuse real fast. You have all these old thoughts, old patterns, old ways of doing things that kick into gear. And it takes a ton of healing, a ton of maturity, a ton of whatever it is, the technique it is to diffuse the situation. But you have to do that in real time, in real fast. And sometimes it doesn't happen. And that's, part of the human condition is having those things in check. So even as an 80-year-old man, you get provoked. And in in his defense, he said he was targeted as it was a hate crime. Like, I don't know if someone said something. I don't know if the guy said something racial or derogatory, but to perceive it as a hate crime would make anyone who's a fighter go 0 to 100, despite your age. And I'm sure alcohol was flowing because it's July 4th. But sometimes you just got to choose your battles. So I just draw that analogy between Jake Paul wanting to fight Tyson, Tyson accepting the fight, them going in and it getting postponed. It got postponed because Tyson had some ulcer flare-ups. But then it got moved to November. So this might be a dream come true. I never thought I'd see Tyson fight again. I was in elementary school when he fought Evander Holyfield for the second time. And there was the infamous biting of the ear. And so now, as a 37-year-old, I'm like, oh, there might be a chance to see this live. The dream would be to get tickets to the show, get tickets to the fight, fly to Dallas, or fly to, is it Houston or Dallas? It's Texas, AT&T Stadium in Texas, to catch that fight. If that doesn't happen, definitely catch it. It'll be fight night, so you go to any sports bar, it'll be on, right? But this will be a moment where it'll be unprecedented that someone came out of retirement this late in the game to fight an up-and-comer, right? I know this happens usually as an exhibition match, but not the full rounds. But this is different because it's heavyweight champion of the world versus this young guy who's famous from YouTube, right? Not dismissing him entirely. He does know how to fight. The rounds, the chops, the skills, the win to loss ratio is not there. It's questionable. You know what I'll say? It's dubious, the involvement in that of in selection of the fighters that he's fighting. And just to be nice, I'll say I wouldn't fight Jake Paul right now, and I feel like I wouldn't really back down from too many fights. Well, that had to be instigated. I'm not here just to fight people. I'm not here to prove anything, right? I got other things to fight for, not fight people with my fists. But there are moments where I'm like, but yeah, I wouldn't, in terms of professional, in the professional arena, I'm not a boxer. I'm not a fighter. If Catalina's in trouble, of course I'm a fighter. I'm a little bit off of topic and starting to ramble. Let's get back to these notes. All right. When it comes to living out the lifestyle of healthy eating, going to the gym, getting that sweat up, getting the heart rate up, most people get burnt out after 6 weeks. You see it every year, New Year's resolutions, right? I think that's part of the beauty of making the joke when my lady is like, hey, you have this food that doesn't jive with what your diet is. I'm like, oh, there goes my New Year's resolutions. And meanwhile, it's halfway over, right? So you guys can steal that if you want. The whole thing that I'm getting at is when you come up with the plan, come up with the routine, stick to the routine, stick to the script. There's no reason to delve off of it, right? Just do the pattern, stick to it, get after it, keep growing. When you hit your goal, you inevitably say, what else can I do? There's a sense of accomplishment. Maybe you talked about it with a bunch of people and they're all celebrating your win. Then you say, what else can I do? That's the same thing. That's the same red thread that was in Jack LaLanne's head. What else can I do? He was doing it at a time when it wasn't a common practice. It was more of an oddity, and then turned it into a $1 billion business, right? And has influenced billions of people around the face of the planet. in your world, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you might find yourself progressing even faster. And if so, you could say, I need to challenge myself. I have to challenge myself. The first thing was overcoming this first mountain. Well, what's the next goal? The tactics and strategies that worked on the first mountain might not work on the second mountain. And I'd actually posit that they won't work. You won't get the same results, or at least not in the same time period. So there's a ebb and flow of progress. And then saying, what's the new strategy? What's the new pattern? If you didn't catch the last episode, I'd cut out alcohol. And that was something that was creating drag, right? This is the resistance in the air that if I'm trying to fly from point A to point B and something is being towed, that creates drag and it affects the efficiency of getting to point B. Cutting alcohol out is getting back to peak performance, right? How does your sleep look? Work on that, set that straight. All of a sudden, you can recover faster and you have more mental clarity, more focus, more drive, and then also just the energy to have that output when you work out. Do it. What's your diet look like? We don't need a lie detector. I think most people would be honest if they're saying how their diet looks. You don't even have to go through the macros. Just say, oh, how's your diet? Is it garbage? Hot trash? Is it decent? Is it okay? Is it tip top? Is it extreme in any direction? Right? All right. How do I let that fall into place? From this point on, and even in the past, I'll always peddle the book Eat Right for Your Blood Type. I think knowing your genetic makeup and then part of what your ancestors ate is key to making your diet fall in line with what your biology and your relatives before you have passed on to this moment. And then keeping that in mind, you would be able to fine tune what goes in, what goes out, and then the byproduct of that. If you are O blood type like me, it's going to be meats and veggies, almost standard. And then everything else will be done in small amounts. Coming down to the style of training is different than, we'll say, A blood type, A, B, B, all of that, right? So if you want to go, if you already hit your goal and you're going to your second mountain now, something has to give. All right, how do you go from regular gas, you know, that 87, to that super, that premium, that 91? Getting on the 91, high octane gasoline, or as our people overseas say, fuel. Right, you're gonna say, what do they say? Petroleum. Is the thing that's necessary to bring to the next level. Who's done it? Has anyone else done it before? Are you a pioneer? That'd be cool, right? Let your legacy be something that changes the expectation for what the standard is for the next generation. A friend of mine recently had said that the relationship of you and your father dictates how you receive love and how you give love. And just thinking about that, I'm like, oh man. Well, my dad was not there, not present. Haven't seen him since I was 3 years old, but my grandfather was there. Because of him, I have the feeling of being able to overcome obstacles, being able to persevere, being dedicated, being steadfast, and being true to my word. Those are things that I want to pass down to Catalina. And if God blesses me with more children, have that instilled in them. I wouldn't have it be this wishy-washy, oh, I hope they turn out to be good people, but it'd be specifically, let me not just tell you, but let me show you by my example, by being present, by being thoughtful, by planning for the future. And there are a ton of areas where I could use a little boost in motivation, or I shouldn't say a little boost for remembering that. And each day, by practicing a little bit of a review of the last 24 hours, that becomes something that is more fine-tuned and say, oh, I can look out for this next time. I noticed I lost my temper with baby girl because she asked me a million questions, multiple times, the same question multiple times. Oh, well, she's 4 years old. So 4-year-olds ask a lot of questions, and sometimes they ask the same question multiple times. It might not be that she wants to know the answer. She might just want to hear my voice. She might want to know that I'm paying attention to her. She might want to see that I care about communicating with her verbally and non-verbally. As the adult in this relationship, I have to remember that and not treat it like if she's one of my boys asking me a question over and over and over again, right? So yeah, that's a little tidbit into the background of my world, and I'm sure it applies to a ton of other people. Oh yeah. All right. When it comes to actually being in the gym, or going to the track, or going to the park, or however you do your training, what is vital is to know what you're doing when you get there, and then be able to carry it out until its completion, whether it's full steam, whether it's 75%, whether it's 60%, or if it's low intensity. Half the battle would be knowing what it looks like, despite the conditions, right? If you say you're gonna run a mile, no matter how long it takes you to do it. If you say, oh, I'm just gonna go to the track and putz around, I'm gonna be a floater, that is a way to shoot yourself in the foot, right? You don't wanna do that. When you go to the area of preference or whatever the training is, have the plan in mind and carry it out. I know when it comes to doing the sprints, the 40-yard dashes, I'm doing between five and six sets. But it's the same exercise every single time. When I roll up on the field, I will be either walking a lap or jogging a lap and then doing some stretches, some active stretching beforehand. That's what primes my mind to be able to do the sprints, right? The 40-yard dashes. On a good day, I don't have to talk myself into doing five sets, right? On a bad day, it usually takes just one warm-up set to kick it in gear. Yesterday, since it was the first time in a little brief hiatus from it, it was on the second set. That's where I said, oh, I'm here. I'm mentally here. And I'm not complaining. I'm not lamenting about other things that I could be doing and how much I don't want to do this or how much I got out of shape cardio-wise. This is something that is might not be on the radar or being consistent with your workout, but it is something that will have long-lasting impact on the quality of your workout. And it's simple as knowing what you're doing, not the why part. The why is what, you know, gets you out of bed in the morning, but the what is you're doing. Are you doing pull-ups, chin-ups, push-ups, burpees, jumping jacks? Are you towing people across the San Francisco wharf? Whatever it is, when you practice it multiple times and becomes habitual and you fall in love with it, it becomes, oh, I'm working out. I'm training. I'm training to do this workout, right? And that is something that is not a fad. It's not something that fades. It's not something that just goes into obscurity, right? This was what was mentioned the other day with the gentleman who was incapacitated and then walked on to the marathon after having not trained physically. He had trained mentally, but he had not trained physically. This is the same thing. Half of it is your mindset on training. They say when you look at some people in the eye, you already know if what they're here to do and if they're about that life. I think that's probably the hardest part about coaching or mentoring people or working out with a friend is saying, oh, it's great that we're here to do this together, but one of us is going to be the weaker link, right? I don't say that in a denigrating way. I say it more as a with the mindset that a team is only as strong as its weakest link. And if you don't know if you're aiding the process, that might be a little bit of a hindrance. And let me just switch for a second and say to know the battlefield, to know what your statistics are, to know what you bring to the table might be something that is the thing that can be fine-tuned and be more of a positive. How do you go from more of a hindrance to a help, right? That level of self-awareness is step one. And step two is what I'm able to do to change it, right? This is the thing that when you're on a team or in a league, that person who gets most improved, right? That's the thing that is being recognized, that last year you were over here. This year, it's stepped up a notch. Oh, right. Last year, it looked like X, Y, and Z. This year, it's been dramatic, a noticeable progression. The progression part is the thing that makes me even say, oh, it is worthwhile to have a podcast about fitness and healthy living, because it is a continuum. It's a sliding continuum, and you can either be on the bottom end of the S curve in the middle or rising up, but nothing is ever static. So it takes a level of self-awareness, dedication, and preparation to make sure you're moving in the positive. Looking at Jack LaLanne, he was definitely the upper tier of the sliding continuum, and to stay there took extreme feats of physical output. I tried not to laugh and smirk and comment, side laughter when describing some of the things that he did, but it's just a moment of saying those didn't just come out of nowhere. He had built up to that and then challenged himself. Years later, 20 years later, he revisits the thing that was completely ridiculous even as a 40-year-old, but he's doing it as a 60-year-old and then going higher from there. So it's just the realization that age is not as much of a factor as a popular culture would have it be. It definitely is a factor, don't get me wrong. But in terms of the consistency throughout the years can show you what the human body is capable of. Rest in peace, Jack LaLanne. He died when he was 96. He was almost 97 years old. He's buried at Forest Lawn Memorial here in in Hollywood. So if you're ever in the neighborhood, you can go visit the grave and see of someone who was not willing to accept that the United States has a health crisis, and not only just not accept it, but did something about it. He showed what could happen when you keep the sugar level low in terms of your intake and your diet, and then what happens when you purposely give your body resistance through weight training, and then how to make it fun. I think that's probably one of the reasons why in the 1930s people were not lifting weights more regularly, was because the amount of effort and not seeing anyone else do it, you're like, oh, well, this is no different than farming or doing manual labor. Well, even if that's what the occupation was, if you were lifting weights, it would only make you better at your job that was physically demanding, right? It's turning something that didn't seem on the outset pleasurable, right? Because it is hard to work out. But then that metamorphosis that happens when you do it, it inspires you in the imagination to go beyond, to go beyond, to go beyond. And I think that's part of what being human's like, saying, what is it possible for me to do? What is it possible for me to help other people do, to help them do? What can we do collectively? And then how do we learn from the past to move forward into the future in impacting the planet in a better way? Oh, well, Jack saw that we were getting out of shape, and that was, you know, almost 100 years ago. little tangent. If anyone hasn't seen the movie WALL-E, check it out. Pixar's WALL-E. It's showing one of my favorite scenes is showing the captain of the ship, seeing their portraits throughout the generations, and they're just getting larger and larger and larger until in the future they're just floating. Floating in this thing. It's like a levitating wheelchair, and it's in the recumbent position. They're just drinking soda all day, right? Oh man. Well, I don't want to pass that down to baby girl. Actually would love it if she was in better shape than I am, or just had that lifestyle so never even got out of shape, right? That is a challenge and a story for another day. All right, wrapping up with my final thoughts would be, set the goal, plan the routine, stick to the script. Don't be a floater. Don't just show up just to say you checked in, checked out, but to try and outdo yourself just a little bit more than what you did the day before. When you rinse, wash, and repeat, you will find yourself going beyond what you thought was possible. And one of my little highlights that I enjoy is on Google Photos. It has what you were doing last year on this day, what you were doing 4 years ago, what were you doing 7 years ago. And today was marked 4 years ago, and that was, I was probably about 6 months into training to be where I am right now. And just to see the structure of my face, I'm like, whoa, I barely even remember that. That was so long ago. And so now, like, okay, if that's what it took to get to where I'm at right now, what can I do 4 years from now where I'd have the same reaction when, and by the way, 4 years from now, I'll be 41, right? So it's so strange to go from a decade to decade getting older, but life marches on and time waits for no man. So that change can start now, whether today's day one, day 1,000, or year 20. I'm looking at my man's Jack LaLanne. I'm like, I'm going to be like that. I already have those habits in place. I already know I'm just expanding and fine tuning. What will I say about this episode of UVU podcast when I'm in my 90s? Hopefully, I'll do a little recap every 10 episodes for people new to the show. But until then, I don't know what that is. Until then, like, subscribe, follow, comment, share, all that jazz. Let me know what you think. If you have any questions, any topics, shoot them out to me, email me, DM me on that IG, and we'll get after it. These are the keys to my success. I can't open the door for you. You're gonna have to open it yourself and walk through. Until then, till we meet again, you versus you. That's what it is at the end of the day. Peace and blessings.